The economy's in trouble, and it's roads and bridges and sewers to the rescue.
$12 billion would go to...
Well, there's $30 billion for highways, and then he's also put money for water and sewer and what have you. And
that's right. It's $30 billion for highways, $12 for transit, and $5 for rail. So,
And so let's just say we'll find out very soon.
Yep.
So how many billions of tax dollars is it going to take to make a difference? That's coming up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 14th. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Great to have you.
Hey, thanks, Adora. In this hour, we continue the conversation on transit dollars. We also look at taxes and the Treasury Secretary nominee, plus the Department of Justice and right-thinking Americans, and a conversation with an Israeli ambassador to the UN. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
As fighting continues in Gaza, there's been a new exchange of fire between Israel and Lebanon. Lebanese militants fired rockets into northern Israel, which responded with artillery shells. It's a tiny skirmish with minimal damage on either side, especially compared to the war Israel and Hezbollah fought there in 2006. Neither side wants another big fight. Lebanon has denied responsibility, shifting blame to rogue militant groups. And Israel says it doesn't want a second front on its northern border. In Gaza, however, the fighting goes on. While missiles land and rockets launch, diplomats are trying to stop the conflict in Gaza. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is in Egypt today asking for attacks on both sides to end immediately. Cairo continues to be a hot spot for diplomats. Envoys from all sides have visited to negotiate an Egyptian ceasefire proposal.
President-elect Barack Obama promises a swift veto if Congress doesn't authorize the rest of the $700 billion bailout. Only half of that money has gone out so far. The veto threat came in a meeting with top Senate Democrats. And today, the Senate dance card full of confirmation hearings. The president-elect's picks to lead the EPA, Agriculture, Veterans Affairs, and Transportation departments all take questions today.
Staying on the economy, we're watching for a retail sales report due later this hour. That data will give us the fullest picture yet of holiday sales. Asian markets closed up just a touch this morning. European markets are currently down. And it was a mixed day on Wall Street yesterday. The Dow edged down, closing at 84.48. And the S&P gained a little bit, ending at 871. And we want to hear about infrastructure stories. It sounds very dry, but we're talking about railways, bridges, roads. A survey came out showing that 80% of Americans are willing to pay higher taxes if they thought they would get some better infrastructure in return. First of all, do you think that's true? And in your neighborhood, what needs doing? We want to hear that story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You know what my new favorite phrase is for the week? Shovel ready.
Shovel ready.
That's right. What is shovel ready in your neighborhood? Adora's right. That's what we want to hear. Any picks in your neighborhood there, Adora?
We're doing okay. Our roads are doing okay so far.
I want bike lanes. More and more bike lanes. That ought to get things humming.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's going to be another busy day in Washington, D.C. as the city gets ready for the inauguration on Tuesday. And Congress is moving ahead with confirmation hearings and expanding a federal child health care program. And then, of course, there's the stimulus package. For the latest, Todd Zwillick, reporter from Capital News Connection, joins us now from Washington. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
And let's start with the nomination process of Treasury Secretary nominee Tim Geithner. And apparently a bit of a snag. It has to do with taxes and an immigrant who worked for the family.
That's right. if this that's Tim Geithner, and if this sounds familiar to anyone,
Zoe Baird, maybe
Zoe Baird, Linda Chavez, Kimba Wood, lots and lots of nominees have gone before Tim Geithner. Zoe Baird and Kimba Wood were both attorney general nominees in the Clinton administration, and Linda Chavez was a nominee for labor secretary for George W. Bush. Each and every one of them had their nominations tanked in part by having a resident in their home or a domestic worker or both who was either illegal or a recent immigrant who was not a citizen who did not have taxes paid on them. Now, there were different permutations. This is part of what's now troubling Tim Geithner, among other things. He appeared before the Finance Committee and some of its investigators yesterday to say that he had made an honest mistake. Also, some back taxes that were not paid when he was an employee at the International Monetary Fund. He said that all of this was an honest mistake and an oversight. And so far, a lot of the key players seem to believe him. Harry Reid, the majority leader, came out yesterday and backed Geithner, used those same words. It's an honest mistake. I understand an honest mistake. Chairman Max Baucus of the Finance Committee, who's in charge of – who will be in charge of either confirming or denying Geithner's nomination in the Finance Committee, also said he felt it was an honest mistake and didn't feel it was an impediment to Geithner's nomination. So as though things aren't complicated enough with the Treasury Department right now and those TARP funds, a little bit of a speed bump for Geithner, I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows whether or not that speed bump will grow into something larger, but we'll have to wait and see. His nomination hearing starts tomorrow.
So do you think in part the Democratic reaction to this is a sign of the times, that we've come further along the road where it takes much more than just not paying your taxes to get your nomination scuttled?
Well, I think part of it is that the Democrats control all three branches, or will shortly. So the amount of dust up, the amount of noise that gets generated, might be dampened a little bit. Republicans don't have quite as big a megaphone as they would if they had more numbers in the Congress. Also, it appears at the moment that a lot of Republican opposition, to the extent that there will be Republican opposition to Obama cabinet nominees, will come tomorrow in the Eric Holder hearing, Eric Holder for Attorney General. The Attorney General slot, as we've said before, is a lightning rod for controversy. Republicans and the Republican base care a lot about judicial issues and that Attorney General office, and they're already mounting some opposition to Holder. So a lot of their energy seems to be focused there right now. It remains to be seen if they focus any on Tim Geithner.
But speaking of which, you kept saying honest mistake. If it was perhaps another cabinet position, we could sort of shrug and go, okay, an honest mistake. This is the Treasury Department. You're not supposed to make any mistakes on your taxes.
No, you're not supposed to. None of them is supposed to make any mistakes on their taxes. Geithner says, by the way, this was caught by the vetters and by Geithner himself, apparently, in all of these back taxes were paid before Geithner was named as Obama's nominee. Of course, he was at the New York Fed before this and did play a role in the first half of the TARP in the way it was spent and the rescue plan. Catherine, you're right. They're supposed to have this stuff sorted out, and you have to wonder how many times do high-profile nominees have to go through the same thing before people get it straight? I don't know the answer to that. Who knows why people do or don't do things? It looks like they caught it relatively – well, they caught it at least before his confirmation hearing, so that's something. And these things always – it's always a matter of what's going on at the time. You know, sometimes people do things that seem rather terrible, and it slides by sometimes.
I'm sure that's going to make Linda Chavez, Zimba Wood, and Zoe Baird feel just great. But it certainly does make you wonder. But we've got a list of things to get through here. So let's move on to the S-CHIP, the expansion of the health care program that will now cover for more than 4 million more children.
Well, if this sounds familiar, it should, because an almost identical bill knocked around the last Congress the last 2 years was vetoed twice by President Bush, and the House came within a dozen votes last year of overriding the veto. They never quite got there. They're going to pass the bill again today, and they won't need the override this time. Barack Obama would sign this bill. The bill will pass easily today by all counts. You're right, raises the number of kids insured under the Children's Health Insurance Program to around 10 million, and they do it by increasing the federal excise tax on tobacco, on a pack of cigarettes, make that excise an even dollar. So hopefully they hope to use the tax structure to have fewer smokers, if possible, but also raise money for children's health insurance. Tobacco state lawmakers obviously don't like the plan too much, but they're in the minority. So this one's going to pass today.
And we're talking about roughly $33 billion over 4.5 years to cover those 10 million children.
That's right.
And, of course, we're talking about a whole lot more than that when it comes to the stimulus package. And it seems that the Obama team is making a full court press to the lawmakers.
Well, Barack Obama was up on the Hill yesterday, met with the Democratic caucus around lunchtime, and did make a full court press, you're right, and it's been followed up with a lot of phone calls around trying to get the stimulus done and trying to get the TARP. Now, these two things are separate, and yet they're all bundled up into the same multi-dozen, $100 billion ball of spending that's going through Congress right now, and it's all a little bit tangled up. The stimulus bill is not done yet. It's probably going to be done by next week because the House committees want to start marking up, want to start processing this big stimulus, potentially $750 billion worth by next week. Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi met with their leadership teams last night, came out to say we're making great progress, but they didn't have any paper to back that up. They don't have any hard numbers yet. They're not giving any indication of what the ratios are with tax cuts and spending and aid to the states, but they say they're making progress, and they say to expect a bill by early next week so those committees can get on the case.
Hang on a minute, Todd. It's early in the morning. The Troubled Asset Relief Program, that's the problem we're trying to take care of, right? That's one chunk of money, and the other chunk of money is the future that we're trying to take care of?
Those two things. Troubled Asset Relief Program, $350 billion. Stimulus, another $700 to $850 billion. On top of that, Catherine, on top of that, yes. Two different things.
And when you're talking about phone calls being made, President-elect Obama is actually making some of those phone calls, I understand, assuring some lawmakers who are concerned about that money going to homeowners, wanting to make sure that homeowners are getting some relief.
Correct. There is almost no one in Congress who's happy with the way the first half, that first $350 billion, was spent by the Bush Treasury Department, by Henry Paulson. So now the administration, sort of in tandem, Bush made the request on Obama's behalf, but the administration has come back and asked for the second half. Now, later this week, probably by Friday, the Senate is going to vote on a resolution of disapproval. This is part of the process, and we don't have to get too terribly into the details, but it is important. There's going to be a resolution of disapproval in the Senate, and that will be the important vote to see whether the Senate rejects the second half of that TARP, says you can't use it, or says, yes, okay, you can use it. And the conditions under which Obama will be able to use the second $350 billion is what's under consideration right now. And it's a bit of an unusual situation because the Senate doesn't want to legislate any new rules.
Right.
Part of that is because Republicans still hold some levers in the Senate. They're not quite irrelevant, not even close to irrelevant, really, under Senate rules. And they don't want a bill because if there's a bill, the Democrats will write it. So what they're headed towards is some kind of agreement, some kind of memo, some kind of understanding. Nobody knows what form that's going to take between the Senate and the House and the Obama administration over what that money will be used for, money for foreclosures, to make sure nobody turns around and does an auto bailout that a lot of Republicans didn't like. They feel like they kind of had that crammed down their throats. More oversight and a full accounting of how the first $350 billion was spent. We're still not quite aware of how some of that money was spent. So all of these things are going to come out. But the interesting thing is that they might come out in some kind of, I don't know, handshake or memo that people sign or don't sign or agree to. So
everything
it's a little
is
rare.
New and different in 2009, Todd Zwillick, and you're actually going to be here with us in New York tomorrow.
Oh, I really look forward to it. It's going to be nice to join you.
We look forward to seeing you, Todd Zwillick. Thanks for that.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick is a reporter for Capital News Connection, and he was coming to us from Washington.
And we want to remind you that if you have a takeaway on infrastructure, where do you want those dollars to go? 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry today. Good morning to you, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, Adora. Now, you might not have heard much about this yet, but there is a very important conference going on right now about your daily commute, the annual conference of the Transportation Research Board, where advocates there fear that all the talk about change for America isn't going to mean much actual change when it comes to transit and infrastructure in this country. Their fear that tax cuts and other measures are going to push out money allocated for infrastructure in the Obama economic stimulus package. Now, The Takeaway's Andrea Bernstein has been in Washington this week at the conference. She joins us now. All right, Andrea, the mood should be upbeat, right? Change in America. We're gonna get it all there.
Well, it's funny because you walk around Washington and you see all kinds of restaurants and shops, and they have these big placards and they say change is coming, change is here, change is just a week away. But I certainly didn't find talking to a lot of these top transit, not just wonks, but in many cases members of Congress who are interested in the issue, policy and top transit officials from around the country, and they're a little depressed. There's a feeling that the sort of grand idea of this infrastructure building bill has turned into a tax cut bill. And as a matter of fact, if you go to the change.gov website right now, that's the transition website, it only has $25 billion total for transportation and infrastructure. And the governors of the states have said they want a trillion. So there's a bit of a difference there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the attitude range from the sort of, you know, give them time, they're, you know, there's not really a White House yet, to what one top transit planner told me. He said they're screwing it up, except that he used another word that we really can't use on the radio. It's kind of like the hangover is coming before the party.
Wow. So tell me, what is it that they want him to do? Like, when someone is envisioning, you know, what they want to see the Obama administration do, what are they telling you?
Well, there's this big tension now because on the one hand, the Obama administration and the president-elect has made it quite clear that he wants speed. He wants shovels on the ground. The big term of art is shovel ready. We'll find the shovel ready projects. We'll put people back to work in 60 days or 90 days. Now, the problem with this is that these shovel ready projects are things that represent sort of the old visions. So what's happening is the change we can believe in is coming right smack up against Washington, and the only way to do things quickly here is to do it the old way. So there's this incredible tension of no, don't do it the old way again, but then this feeling of if we don't do it the old way, there will be nothing. And I was at a forum with Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell the other day. He's one of the members of this national infrastructure group. And we have a clip of him talking about sort of him urging Barack Obama to do the right thing on this. And you can really hear the sort of the anxiety in his voice, almost the pleading that, you know, don't get it wrong.
This is the time. He has an 82% approval rating. He's never going to have a higher approval rating. He has the American people on his side. He has to press one button and send out one email, and he'll get letters and emails into congressmen's offices that make the NRA look like a second-class organization. He can do it.
Wow. All right, so here you have all this tension. People are begging for, you know, the administration to do something. But you were talking about, you know, doing things the old-fashioned way. Doesn't that sort of set us up, though, for some of the same problems we were trying to fix?
Well, exactly. And, you know, that is one of the big discussions that's going on here. And you sort of have at this transportation conference the road people, the people that represent sort of the highways and the bridges and that have traditionally controlled all these federal highway appropriations, all these federal transportation appropriations. Then you have the mass transit people who say, you know, reduce your carbon footprint, start doing these mass transit programs because you're going to create a problem for yourself if you don't start addressing that, if you just start building more roads. And as a matter of fact, I asked John Horsley. He's the executive director of the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. And he was at the conference, and I spoke to him. And, you know, that's the group that usually wins because everybody, every member of Congress likes to get a new road. They like to get a ribbon cutting. It's very popular. But I said to him, well, if you build more lanes, are you encouraging more people to drive, thereby creating a problem with the carbon footprint? He didn't like that question. This is what he said.
I think that your question is naive. Let me give you an example. Both of us, from time to time, travel across the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. That was a $2.5 billion project that doubled the capacity of that bridge from 6 to 12 lanes, two lanes set aside for transit. It has markedly reduced congestion and made it possible to travel in this region. So it was a great investment. It added the capacity that was desperately needed. It's serving the region better, and it's reduced congestion. So everybody wins.
But has it created more cars on the road?
The reason you have more cars on the road in this region is we've been growing.
Okay, I think we've heard that argument before. How was this expected to all play out, Andrea?
Well, listen to this cut. This is the last one I've got, and it's three guys on a panel. They're top lobbyists and federal officials. And I said to them, so what is in this bill for transit? See if you can hear the answer and what they say.
The ballpark is somewhere between $25 billion at this point. If you look at the Overstar number of, what is it, $42.5 billion, seems to be the range.
Actually, the Overstar proposal is $85 billion for transportation, of which $12 billion would go to
Well, there's $30 billion for highways, and then he's also put right. $20 for water and sewer and
right.
what have you. And
that's right. $30 billion yeah. for highways, $12 for rail, $12 for transit, and $5 for rail. So.
Right.
And so let's just say we'll find out very soon.
Yep.
Okay, Andrea, my favorite poker game, Transit Hold'em. That's the takeaway is Andrea Bernstein in Washington this week at the annual conference of the Transportation Research Board. Thanks. And now we're going to turn to Femi Okay with the latest from the newsroom.
Thank you. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. President-elect Barack Obama is urging lawmakers to release the remainder of the financial bailout funds. Yesterday, he told Senate Democrats that he will veto any move Congress makes to prevent the money from going through. His transition team will now make the case to Republican lawmakers, and a vote could come as early as tomorrow. Meanwhile, the man who would be in charge of all of that money faces problems of his own. Treasury Secretary appointee Tim Geithner has had to delay his confirmation hearing because of a troubled tax history. He failed to pay federal income taxes for several years. He also employed a housekeeper who lacked proper work papers. A new hearing is tentatively scheduled for Friday. Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden has posted a new audio tape this morning urging Muslims to launch a holy war to stop the Israeli offensive in Gaza. It was posted today on Islamic militant websites. And before his impeachment trial begins in the state Senate, Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has to swear lawmakers in, presiding over the chamber that will decide his political future. Has a look at some headlines making news this morning.
All right, thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer in today for John Hockenberry. It's less than a week before the inauguration, and we're looking for your stories. Are you going? Are you celebrating at home with friends? Oh, come on. What are you wearing? We want to follow you as you commemorate Barack Obama's inaugural. Give us a call at 1-877-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Because what you're wearing, Catherine, of course, is quite important.
You know people are thinking about it.
This next story is about the latest Inspector General report that for some reflects the greater issue of one of the Bush administration's legacies. A Justice Department report has found that a former senior official in the administration routinely used an ideological litmus test in evaluating job candidates. He was looking for what he called RTAs, right-thinking Americans, to hire people for what were supposed to be apolitical jobs. And it's alleged that he lied to a congressional panel investigating the practice. We're joined now by Slate senior legal correspondent Dahlia Lithwick. Good morning and welcome back, Dahlia.
Thank you for having me.
Now, can you explain the details to us of the report's conclusions?
Well, this is the fourth in a series of massive internal reports that were undertaken at the Justice Department by its Inspector General, and it was all of it looking into these questions of politicization of the Justice Department, whether the Justice Department had crossed the line from an independent agency to becoming very, very partisan and ideological. And as you'll recall, these IG reports have detonated over the past couple of years, mm-hmm. each of which on various issues, from Alberto Gonzalez himself and his own doings at the department to Monica Goodling and other junior staffers, what was being done at Justice that would have really crossed the line into blatant political action. This one looked just into the activities of this former official, Brad Schlotzman, who was helped to lead the Civil Rights Division from 2003 until 2007, and he was all bound up in the U.S. attorney scandal for all sorts of reasons we can go into. And so the question was whether he had impermissibly crossed that line into blatantly political hiring and firing at the department, and the IG report concluded unequivocally not only that he had crossed the line, that he had clearly broken the civil service laws with partisan activity at the department, but also that he had misled Congress in testimony about that.
And so, Dahlia, what's the consequence for that?
Well, that's the big question. This was referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia for prosecution. They sat on this report since July, and then this week, apparently, when it was released, they indicated that they were not going to prosecute him for anything. The department has clarified, the U.S. Attorney's Office at least has clarified, they were only looking at this narrow question of whether his lies to Congress were prosecutable, and they just determined that it wasn't.
They sat on this since July?
Right. This report was apparently concluded in July.
Is it possible that the Obama administration could follow up and pursue some kind of action?
It certainly is possible. I think that the signals we've been getting from the Obama administration on issues as sort of relatively trivial as this question of politicization at Justice to the much larger issues of are they going to prosecute, you know, senior Bush administration officials for things as serious as torture policy and eavesdropping policy. All the signals we've been getting so far have been pretty consistent. The signals are we're going to fix the errors, we're going to fix the mistakes, we're going to make sure things like this never happen again, but we're not really interested in looking backward. And President-elect Obama made statements to that effect to George Stephanopoulos on Sunday. As to the larger issues about prosecuting wrongdoing with respect to torture, my sense is that the feeling is we're going to move forward, we're not going to dwell on the wrongdoing of the past. We really, really think that drilling down into, you know, individual criminal liability is mm-hmm. a waste of political capital.
But this instance certainly does exemplify what many critics have said is a legacy of the Bush administration, of this lack of oversight essentially across the board through many agencies, and no consequences for questionable behavior. And sometimes, as you've said in this case, unequivocally there was some wrongdoing found, but again, no consequence.
It's a really interesting mirror image. It occurred to me this morning thinking about this, that the lack of consequences for things like this, and this is, as I said, the fourth IG report, each of them has found wrongdoing, and yet nothing is being done other than repairing the department, which, let's agree, I think that Michael Mukasey, the current attorney general, has done a lot to fix the most brazen politicization of the department. But the fact that nothing's being done on these sort of small, you know, inmates running the asylum, you know, little kids who were just way out of bounds in terms of how political they were. And this report really shows emails and conversations that are shocking coming from an adult who was entrusted with running the Civil Rights Division. But there's something sort of interesting about, on the one hand, seeing this as too trivial to prosecute, too silly, and on the other hand, looking at things like the torture memos and the eavesdropping policy as too serious to prosecute. It does raise the question of what in between these two things would be worth going after, investigating, and prosecuting. So in some interesting ways, I think, this is seen as just so bizarre and just bad management by Gonzalez, hiring bad people, letting them do their thing. At the other end of the spectrum, there's this notion that David Addington, John Yoo, and the architects, and Donald Rumsfeld, the architects of the torture policy, were too serious and important to be prosecuted.
Well, it's certainly an interesting dichotomy, and moving forward, we'll have to see what fixes the Obama administration believes they can make given the dynamics that they're walking into. Dahlia Lithwick, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick is Slate's senior legal correspondent. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got a few headlines for us.
And the time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. There's been no let-up in fighting in and around Gaza City. Our partners, the BBC, is reporting sporadic explosions and heavy clashes between Israeli troops and Palestinian militants. And the clashes were still going on during the scheduled daily three-hour pause to allow civilians to shop for essentials. We will have more on the prospects for a ceasefire in the next few minutes. Retail sales have plunged more than expected by 2.7% in December, and that's for the record sixth straight month. President-elect Barack Obama and Vice President-elect Joe Biden will pay a pre-inaugural visit to the Supreme Court this afternoon. They were invited by Chief Justice John Roberts. It's the third time in recent history that an incoming administration has visited the court. Patients at Veterans Affairs hospitals around the country have been exposed to incorrect drug dosages because of computer software errors. There is no evidence that any patient was harmed. The VA is still investigating the matter. Eric Shinsky, the appointee to head the VA affairs, has pledged to modernize the agency. His confirmation hearing is today. Yahoo's new CEO says that all the company needs, and I'm going to quote her here, a little management and some breathing room. The company announced that it was hiring Carol Bartz yesterday, and she replaces Jerry Yang, who left after potentially lucrative deals with Microsoft and Google both collapsed. Some of the stories making big news for you this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm Catherine Lanford. The UN Secretary General is calling for an immediate halt to the fighting in Gaza and says that intense negotiations are needed to come up with the necessary arrangements. Ban Ki-moon has begun a week-long trip to the region in Egypt to resolve the crisis in the Gaza Strip. And we're going to turn now to Magdi Abdelhadi. He's the BBC correspondent in Cairo, and he joins us now live. Now, Magdi, given that fighting is continuing even during a scheduled three-hour pause today, what are the prospects for a ceasefire this week?
Well, we have been sort of, there was a sense of, you know, we're almost there early in the week when the international envoy for the Middle East, former Prime Minister, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, was here, met President Mubarak, and after that he gave a very upbeat assessment saying, you know, all the elements are there on the table and we just got to press harder and we'll get there. Then, at the start of the week, it felt like we're almost there. Hamas delegation has been, or then was there twice. There was an Israeli delegation on the way to Cairo that has been put off. So suddenly we are sort of in a state of not knowing when will the breakthrough happen. You know, we're getting reports about let me just remind the listeners of what's on the table. What's on the table is a Franco-Egyptian initiative that calls for a provisional ceasefire to be followed by talks on a long-term ceasefire, the reopening of the border crossings, and crucially, for Hamas, Israel, and Egypt, the Israelis want new security measures along the border between Gaza and Egypt to ensure that there will be no more smuggling of weapons from Egypt into Gaza, so that once there is a ceasefire, Hamas cannot rearm and pose the same threat. And now what we hear is that Hamas are objecting to that particular item because the idea that there will be monitors along the border on the Hamas side of the border, on the Gaza side of the border, and Hamas is adamant, not on my territory, and the Egyptians won't have it on their territory either. So also Hamas doesn't want the ceasefire to be given free of charge. You want the ceasefire to be connected to immediate Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza territory, and Israel doesn't like that idea. So what will it take to bridge that gap? I believe a lot of arm twisting, more fighting. What is happening on the ground will ultimately, who's going to blink first, sorry. Possibly the arrival of the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to Israel, will he be able to put pressure on the Israelis? I doubt it, given the fact that there is already a United Nations Security Council resolution calling on both sides for an immediate halt to the fighting, and that has been ignored. So I just don't see why should the Secretary General himself make all the difference.
Very succinctly, Magdi, what's at stake for the Egyptians, since we're talking about Cairo?
Sorry, can you repeat that question again?
What's at stake exactly? Remind people, what's at stake for the Egyptians?
Oh, it's vital because, you know, this is happening in the Egyptians' backyard. It's, you know, there's violence there. I mean, could easily spill over, potentially destabilizing. Public opinion is very much pro-Palestinians. The longer this goes, the more pressure President Mubarak comes under. And he has enough problems, domestic problems in his plate. It's the last thing he wants to see, an ongoing humanitarian, disastrous humanitarian situation next door.
All right. Magdi, I want to thank you for joining us. That is Magdi Abdelhadi. He is a BBC correspondent. They're, of course, one of our partners here on The Takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, January 14th, and Femi Oke has the latest headlines of the morning.
Hello there. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. The Senate schedule today is packed with confirmation hearings. The president-elect's picks to lead the EPA, Agriculture, Veterans Affairs and Transportation departments all take questions today. Now, it's a bit unusual to hold confirmation hearings before the president takes office. The Senate wants the Obama cabinet in place quickly to take on the economy and other pressing problems. The weather is brutal in the Midwest. A cold snap brought sub-freezing temperatures and snow to the region, and this led to hundreds of flight cancellations. And that weather system is now heading east, where it will batter the northeast. In Europe, they're still struggling through winter without a key natural gas supply. A chunk of gas supplies to Europe has been cut off because of a dispute between Russia and Ukraine. Both of those countries blame each other for Europe's lack of gas. Several European heads of state are in Russia and Ukraine today, pushing to get the gas turned back on. Pirates have lost another battle. The Russian Navy foiled an attack by Somali pirates on a container ship. Pirates fired on the ship but abandoned their attempts to board after a Russian chopper and warship made it to the scene. A beefed-up international presence has stopped several recent pirate strikes in those dangerous waters. President Bush is doing his last few interviews as commander-in-chief this week. Yesterday, the president, his wife, and CNN talk show host Larry King talked about his last 8 years in office. The president revealed that he's taken a hit personally in the financial meltdown. Dick Cheney really is a great person and not secretly in charge of the administration. And more importantly, the president also wished the president-elect good luck with his attempt to close Guantanamo Bay.
I said we were going to try to close Guantanamo, too. Problem is, you've got a bunch of cold-blooded killers down there that if they ever get out, they're going to come and kill Americans, and I'd hate to be the person that made that decision.
President Bush will make his official televised goodbye on Thursday evening.
Thanks very much, Femi. A full-court diplomatic press is underway to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza. Egyptian mediators are pushing Hamas to accept a truce proposal. Israel is sending its lead negotiator to Cairo for, quote, decisive talks. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is there today at the start of his Middle East tour. Joining us is Ambassador Daniel Carmon, the Deputy Permanent Representative of Israel to the United Nations. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you very much, and good morning.
How would you describe the current state of negotiations in Egypt?
Well, I would say, as your reporter said before, and as you did so rightly, there are two paths now going on. One is our military campaign continuing until conditions are set that would allow the hostilities to stop. And the other are really intensive diplomatic deliberations for a week now, concentrated in this channel between us and Egypt, and we have our top negotiator, Mr. Amos Gilad, that is going back and forth for some days now. So we certainly hope that we will be able to finish those two paths in a way that would be respectable on the one hand and that would set the conditions on the other.
I'd like to get your reaction to what the Secretary General said yesterday. This is Ban Ki-moon.
My message is simple, direct, and to the point. The fighting must stop. And to both sides, I say, just stop now. Too many people have died. There has been too much civilian suffering.
Ambassador, do you have faith in the UN's ability to help facilitate some kind of ceasefire?
We respect very much the international community. We respect very much the United Nations. We are part of the United Nations, and the United Nations might play a role on a later stage, I would say. The Secretary General said one more thing yesterday, which is enough is enough. Israel has been saying enough is enough for some time now when it started unwillingly this military campaign against terror in its fight against terror. So we are also saying enough is enough, and this is what we've been doing in the past 3 weeks now.
When you say you believe that the UN may be able to aid in some way later, can you explain more of what you mean?
Yes, definitely. I think the United Nations, through its organs and through its various bodies and mandates, usually starting with resolutions, the UN is a very, by definition, a very politicized organization. And if you look at what is going on nowadays, instead of supporting Israel in its fight against terrorism, which is one of the values of the United Nations, the deliberations in the United Nations reflect the formation of the United Nations, which is a parliamentary body. And what we're seeing, for example, is the Human Rights Council meeting in Geneva 2 days ago, setting out a resolution that is completely unbalanced, that is portraying only one side, not because the reality is one-sided, but because the countries that are part of this council are deciding that this is what should get out of this council, which is a condemnation of Israel. So the reflection of reality in various UN bodies is really, I would say, a mockery. On the other hand, we have the Security Council, which is a very responsible body that tried since December 27 to try to help out, deliberated in various meetings. We, Israel, felt that it was a bit premature because we felt that first the conditions should be set on the ground and then Security Council should meet. But as a whole, I would say the United Nations are hastily deliberating without really trying to see the real problem. And the real problem is terrorism, which must be fought. And this is what Israel is doing in self-defense.
Ambassador, let's talk about the Security Council for a second. Do you consider it helpful that 14 out of the 15 members of the Security Council supported the UN resolution, which essentially calls for an immediate, durable, and fully respected ceasefire leading to the full withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza? Is that helpful?
We have been saying for almost two weeks now that we feel that if the UN and if the Security Council would really want to deal with this issue, it should wait a little bit until the conditions are set on the ground. And forgive me for repeating this, but this is really crucial. The fact that the Security Council meets and has to set out a resolution, and I must give you for a second the real context, the big context. Last week there was a big delegation of Arab Arab foreign minister, very respectable delegation of Arab foreign minister here. The agenda on the table was, of course, the situation in Gaza, but many of those foreign ministers represented countries that by themselves, directly or indirectly, could be also threatened by Hamas. Hamas is an organization that threatens not only 1 million Israeli citizens in southern Israel. Hamas is also an organization that toppled the Palestinian Authority in a violent and bloody coup not so long ago. Hamas is an organization that could threaten other regimes in our region, the stability in our region. Mm-hmm. And the same ministers came last week here to pressure the United Nations, to pressure their fellow colleagues to pass a resolution that would call for a ceasefire. So there was some kind of, if I may say, double talk last week. And I would say that this resolution is not something that came to solve the problem. This resolution came maybe to let out steam, maybe to answer other preoccupations. But yes, we have this resolution.
And it certainly makes for very difficult diplomacy. Ambassador Daniel Carmon, we're going to have to leave it there, but we do thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Ambassador Daniel Carmon, Deputy Permanent Representative of Israel to the United Nations.
Okay, Adora, it's less than a week before the inauguration, and we are asking people to tell us what their plans are. Are you going? Are you celebrating at home? We want to follow you as you commemorate Barack Obama's, oh, that's nice, isn't it, inauguration. I can make you laugh. That's worth it. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, here is your takeaway for the day.
These shovel-ready projects are things that represent sort of the old visions.
Okay, that is the takeaways. Andrea Bernstein talking about the difficulties the Obama administration is going to face with what we call shovel-ready projects. Now, if you want to take the takeaway with you, don't forget to look at our podcast. It's all at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanford.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
In Illinois, state lawmakers have been comparing their government to a freak show, and that was before today.
That'll be an historical first, to accept the oath of office from a governor that's been impeached.
Springfield needs someone to swear in its representatives, and embattled Governor Rod Blagojevich is not in handcuffs yet. Raise your right hand. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It's Wednesday, January 14th. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. A great pleasure. Good to see you and good morning.
Hey, Adora. Good morning. All right, everybody. Let's try this at home. We're going to follow the money on the bank bailout, which, by the way, isn't easy. We're also going to ask former EPA head Christine Todd Whitman what advice she has for her successor in the Obama administration. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
As fighting continues in Gaza, there's new crossfire between Israel and Lebanon. Lebanese militants fired rockets into northern Israel, which responded with artillery shells. Here's Israeli police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld.
We have heightened security around the area along the northern border, and we're assessing the situation as to what could take place.
Damage was minimal on both sides. Analysts don't expect the fighting to evolve into another full-scale fight. Full-scale fighting continues to rage in Gaza, though. West Bank Palestinian leader Saeb Erekat says the Palestinian people must support the Egyptian ceasefire plan.
All Palestinian factions, Fatah, Hamas, all others, must be united in backing the Egyptian efforts to stop the Israeli attack and stop the massacres against our people.
Leaders from the region and around the world have all stopped in Cairo for peace talks, including Israel and Hamas.
Osama bin Laden is apparently weighing in on the conflict. A new audio tape urges Muslims to launch a holy war against the Israeli offensive. The recording is not authenticated yet, but it appeared on a website that al-Qaeda has used in the past. And the voice appears to match bin Laden's. A day of cabinet confirmation hearings kicks off this next hour in the Senate. President-elect Obama's choices to head the EPA, Agriculture, Veterans Affairs, and Transportation Departments all take questions today. Also, the president-elect promises a swift veto if Congress doesn't authorize the rest of the $700 billion bailout. This is in a meeting with top Senate Democrats. Half of the bailout money, of course, still on hold.
And speaking of the bailout bill, companies getting government rescue money can now keep their expensive private jets. A rule in the bill originally banned those planes, but lawmakers lobbied against it, saying it threatened jobs at private air companies. That means no security lines for CEOs.
Asian markets closed up just a touch this morning. European markets are currently down. It was a mixed day on Wall Street yesterday. The Dow edging down, closing at 84.48. The S&P gaining a little bit, ending at 8.71.
And we're watching for retail sales report, a report that's due out later this hour. And that data will give us the fullest picture yet of holiday sales. And we're also thinking about the inauguration because we are days away. And we want to know what your plans are. Are you making special plans for that day? Are you going to Washington, D.C.? Are you celebrating at home with friends? Are you boycotting it? We want to hear your plans for the commemoration or not of Barack Obama's inauguration. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. President-elect Barack Obama is lobbying hard for the remaining $350 billion in the federal bailout funds. And reportedly, he's privately delivered a threat to fellow Democrats that if they deny him the money, he could potentially veto any anti-bailout legislation. Today's New York Times has an in-depth report about the many issues revolving around the money already given to banks. Eric Lipton is the reporter on the story and joins us from Washington. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
So your story, your research, your reporting focuses on the Independent Bank of Michigan. The bank received $72 million in federal money. What happened?
Right. This is a relatively small bank, I mean, compared to the giant money center banks, it has taken its piece of the federal bailout funds and simply returned it to the federal government temporarily by paying down some of its debt with the Federal Reserve. But it hasn't yet actually put the money back out there through loans, which was the goal of the program.
So has the money helped the bank?
The money has helped the bank look more attractive potentially to investors that might consider buying its stock, because now its balance sheet is a little more attractive. It's the bank is slightly healthier, but it hasn't really brought the benefits perhaps to Michigan that Congress thought when it appropriated all of this money to try to stimulate the economy.
So $72 million went to this bank, but people in the community never saw a dollar of that.
Well, so far that is the case. It essentially was stuffed into the mattress. It was used to sort of, build up the strength of the bank, and it has not yet been given out in through additional loans. Now, the bank asserts that the trouble is that there aren't many people out there who want to borrow money right now to buy new cars, to buy new homes, businesses, to build new factories. And the real problem, they assert, is that there aren't people looking for loans, not that they don't want to give them.
Well, that's the first I've heard of that. Was it difficult to trace the money?
Well, so far, there's very little that the federal government has required of the banks in terms of explaining what they're doing with it. Prior to this week, they basically, a dollar went into the system, and it essentially mixed in with all the other dollars that a bank has. And there was no way really of knowing where the money went, how it was used, how much good was coming from that federal investment. And so now the federal government is starting to ask banks. As of Monday, for example, the FDIC notified the banks that it expects to be told how this money is being used. So there can be some evaluation of just how effective this program is.
That seems really late, to be honest, considering many of these banks have had this money for months. And the reason why I ask you if it was difficult to trace is because on Monday we talked to former Senator John Sununu, who's currently on the Oversight Committee of this bailout money, and he said that was one of their big challenges, was figuring out the model on how they follow the money and then how they measure how beneficial it is to the bank, to the economy.
It did seem a little crazy. You've got $192 billion that has been given out to 257 different banks across the United States. Many of them in really tiny chunks of money, is as small as $1 million per bank, and for some of the smallest of the institutions. And yet there was no requirement when all of this money was distributed that they explain to the federal government and therefore to the public, how are they using this money? And, so far there is no explanation of that and no way to evaluate, therefore, just what are we getting for that investment?
It certainly is extraordinary that there was no mechanism to force these banks to lend and to flush the system, the economic system, with the cash it needs to keep rolling along.
Yeah, I mean, that's another sort of open question as to whether or not, there should have been something that mandated that they use it for lending. The Treasury, the Neil Kashkari, who runs the program for Treasury, who I interviewed for the story, explained that he thinks that even if the lending is perhaps not increasing, it at least will be higher than it otherwise would have been. And, again, that's a hard thing to measure. If overall lending is not growing, but it's just somewhat higher than the dire place that it's at, how do you evaluate that? And he said, well, he thinks at least he's confident that at least is happening.
Eric, that's actually disturbing because, again, how do you measure? Is that worth $1 billion, $10 billion, $100 billion? Eric Lipton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Lipton is a national reporter in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times with a front page story today.
Hey, Adore, let's turn now to Dan Gross. He's a senior editor at Newsweek, and we're going to talk to him in a moment about the shrinking financial supermarket Citigroup. But first, Dan, we'd like to get your take on the bank bailouts. We were just talking about what happens when you actually follow the money. What does it tell us?
Well, I think it's not surprising. You have a kind of confluence of two events. A lot of these banks were either functionally bankrupt or looking at further losses down the road. So what did they do when they got money? They stowed it away for a rainy day, or they used it to patch holes. It's like if you had a house that was in really bad disrepair and you were able to get some mortgage financing, you wouldn't go out and buy a new house. You might use some of it to patch up the roof, and you might hold the rest in reserve because you think the furnace is going to, give out on you this summer or this winter, excuse me. And that's basically what's happened. The second thing is the demand question is a real one. What got us into trouble was reckless lending. Anybody who wanted a loan got one. you know, banks let their standards down. Now, of course, they go 180 degrees in the other direction. Everybody gets a loan. Now nobody gets a loan. And with people feeling fearful and not having jobs, and with, you know, the economy shrinking, you don't have businesses sort of banging down the door saying, hey, give me $10 million so I can start a new plant.
Hey,
so there's a kind of cyclicality here.
Speaking of shrinking, let's look at the rapidly thinning Citigroup. It was a financial supermarket, and now they're selling bits and pieces off. Talk about the Morgan Stanley deal. What's going on here, and what does it mean?
But look, you know, Citigroup's ad slogan used to be, the city never sleeps. I think it now should be City Sleeps with the Fishes.
Dan, you took time to think that up.
I've been thinking of that.
What's going on?
Citigroup was, they called themselves either a universal bank or a financial supermarket, which was this notion that one institution would do everything possible in financial services. They would sell insurance, they would sell stocks, they would have a retail bank, they'd have a commercial bank, investment bank, they would run hedge funds, they would do all these things. That is now being dismantled. So it's as if you were taking your sort of Whole Foods and carving up the cheese section into a cheese shop and you know, all the other ones into boutique operations. They are having to slim down because lashing all these businesses together, not only did it not produce any synergies, it just meant that when the markets went down, you had eight or nine businesses in the same poor area rather than one. They didn't get any diversification by being in different lines of lending and different lines of financial activity. So the first thing they're doing is essentially selling off their brokerage unit, that's Smith Barney, you know, all the stockbrokers, people who handle individual investors, and combining that with Morgan Stanley's operations. That's to raise some money, to slim down, and it's a prelude of more things to come.
Hey, we should remind everyone, there was a massive bailout for Citigroup back in November. So what does this, all this thinning down, the selling off, the thinning down mean for the bailout money? What does that mean for taxpayers as far as Citigroup is concerned?
Well, you know, Smith Barney is not a lending business, so there was never an assumption that some of the bailout money would be,
right,
you know, put to work through them. It is, however, you know, a relatively profitable business, even in bad times. People still need their money managed. They still make trades. They are going to rack up a big gain. They're going to get some cash from this, which will help patch up their balance sheet and may help forestall further requests. The problem with Citigroup is that even if they realize $3 or $4 billion from this, you know, in the scheme of their balance sheet, they had, I think, well over $1 trillion in loans and liabilities out there. It doesn't make all that much of a difference. But so this is part of a move to bring in more capital, to slim down, to try to get them on a more stable financial footing.
All right. I want to thank you for joining us.
Anytime.
Dan Gross is a senior editor for Newsweek.
And you know what? Right now, Catherine, I have the inauguration on my mind of President-elect Barack Obama. What are you going to be doing?
I hope I'm going to be monitoring at home, but you never know.
Susan writes to us on our website that she's going to be celebrating Obama's inauguration by giving a lecture on the ceremony and explaining his speech to her Japanese students, who she says are as enthusiastic about it as any American. Well, so what's your story for Inauguration Day? What are you planning to do? Are you going to Washington? Are you going to listen to it on the radio or watch it on TV or with your children? 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to hear about how you are going to mark the day or not.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Wednesday, January 14th. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You know, it's days before the inauguration. We're looking for your stories. Are you going? Are you celebrating with friends at home? Maybe you're boycotting the ceremonies. We'd like to follow you as you commemorate Barack Obama's inauguration. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's a response, Adora. Tell me when it's over, was my late husband's comment whenever mass media events like this were going to take place. Those are my sentiments, too. Okay, make a note. We need to tell her when it's over, Adora.
We certainly will. And we're actually going to move on to a story that's happening in the president-elect's home state of Illinois. There's never a dull moment there, it seems. This afternoon, embattled Governor Rod Blagojevich will swear in the very same state senators who will decide later this month whether or not to remove him from office. We're joined now by Amanda Vinicky, a State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio, for more. Good morning and welcome back, Amanda.
Thank you.
So the swearing-in ceremony is certainly going to make for some interesting moments today. How are lawmakers describing their feelings about it all?
You know, for a while there had been some anticipation that perhaps we would see some Blagojevich-esque antics and that he would maybe refuse to come, that he would, you know, use the opportunity to make another statement, chastise the House some more, as he has been prone to do, perhaps even refuse to swear the Senate in to kind of delay the impeachment. But it looks like he's not going to do that, and I think that he's going to be kind of in return from the Senate greeted in a cordial, statesmanlike manner. There'd been some anticipation, you know, would the senators refuse to shake his hand if he offers it? Will they not clap? What will they do? Obviously, it hasn't happened yet, so we're not quite sure, but most people say that they will be cordial. The lawmakers that I've talked to say, you know, it's their duty to do so.
Let's listen to Senator Dave Severson, a Republican who sounds almost weary.
He still needs to continue to act as the governor, so he'll come in and do his job, and then my guests will leave. But he needs to do his job, and hopefully he will appear and fulfill that, so we won't have to go through all the steps of what other options are available.
Sounds like some uncertainty there. Hopefully he will come. He still needs to do his job, my guess.
As you can imagine, there's not a lot of trust in Governor Blagojevich right now from these lawmakers. Senator Severson says, you know, he's supposed to do that. We can't boycott or anything. And his point is that it's the position that's supposed to have this duty in the Illinois Constitution. It's just this, you know, small little phrase that is causing all of this right now. And it says the governor shall convene the Senate to elect from its membership a president of the Senate as presiding officer on the first day of the January session of the General Assembly in odd-numbered years. I mean, and that's what's causing all this. So, like I said, they're trying to keep the point that it's the position, not the governor himself or any one personality.
Well, that's the point, though, right? That's the irony here, which is the governor has to swear in these representatives who are the very same ones who want him out.
Mm-hmm, exactly. This Senate, the way that this, now that the governor has been impeached last week by the Illinois House, the first time in state history that this has been done with a sitting governor, it's up to now the Senate to hold a trial. And the Senate supposedly is going to even kind of begin its very first day. The real proceedings won't begin until the 26th, but there has been talk about the Senate, after they're inaugurated, passing the rules for that very Senate trial that will be used against potentially Governor Rod Blagojevich. And so, yeah, that's one reason why I think he probably may actually not do anything crazy today in hopes of, I guess, swaying the jury. These senators are his jury, and he issued a statement after the House impeachment saying, you know, these House people, they're all biased. I've been fighting with them for a long time. This impeachment's been long in coming, but the Senate, that's where I have hope. The outcome will be different.
Except that, you know, talk for a minute about what kind of trial this is going to be. I mean, I think people might be thinking that this is going to be like a courtroom trial.
Uh-huh.
You see already.
Some courtroom TV type thing,
right?
Or Law and Order, perhaps.
But it's not going to be like that at all.
No, and you know, they do say it will resemble a trial, and this is such new ground that nobody's really quite sure how it will look. The House will have an attorney who will be acting as a prosecutor, and senators themselves may be called as witnesses. There's no word if, you know, that will happen or not. So there will be witnesses called, but no, it's not. And there's a Chief Justice of the Illinois State Supreme Court will kind of preside over things during the trial, but no, it's not going to necessarily work like you would see it on courtroom TV. And other than that, you know, we really don't know. This is quite new.
Okay. Now, if you don't live in Illinois, Governor Blagojevich is one great Saturday Night Live skit after another. But talk about, you know, this trial could take up some time. What's really at stake here for the people of Illinois? What's not getting addressed?
You know, there's a lot here. Illinois' budget is in shambles. We have infrastructure needs. I know you were just talking about that on the program, and ours here in the state of Illinois are fairly dire, and trust issues with Governor Blagojevich have prevented anything from being done about that for years since he took office. So there's a lot riding on this and a lot of interest in hurrying up this trial to move on and find out who will be governor. Can he sign bills? What can be done to really move things forward?
And it might turn out to be Rod Blagojevich, but of course we'll see, right, Amanda?
We will see.
Amanda Vinicky is the State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio, and we thank her. And now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got some headlines for us.
At 27 minutes past the hour, this could be the voice of America's most wanted terrorist.
Al-General al-Britani Gulubasha, fakayfa tantasiru ummatun?
Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden has posted a new audio tape urging Muslims to launch a holy war to stop the Israeli offensive in Gaza. The tape was posted today on Islamic militant websites. Now, the authenticity of the tape cannot be independently confirmed, but the voice does resemble how bin Laden has sounded in previous messages. President-elect Barack Obama says that he will veto any effort to stop the release of additional bailout funds. That's what he told Senate Democrats in a closed-door lunch yesterday. It may have worked. Several Democrats say that Congress could pass it within the week. The Oakland Transit police officer who allegedly shot an unarmed man has been arrested in Nevada. The shooting was captured on video and has led to numerous protests. There's been no immediate announcement of the charges. The threat to children of online sexual predators is overblown. According to a new report, it's the result of a year-long collaboration of academics, experts in childhood safety, and executives of companies like Yahoo and MySpace. They say that cyberbullying is a much bigger concern, and they also say that parental involvement is essential in preventing it. Iraq is now amongst the nations banning the use of chemical weapons. It ratified the ban yesterday at the United Nations, and the move was welcomed by the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Iraq is one of the few countries known to have used chemical weapons in recent years, and the country employed them in the 1980s under Saddam Hussein, which killed thousands of Iraqi Kurds. That's a look at some of the big stories making the news headlines for you this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Barack Obama's inauguration is just days away, and we are dying to hear your stories about whether you're going to the inauguration, are you going to watch it, are you celebrating with friends at home? Perhaps you're going to be looking for a job and hoping that the Obama administration can turn the economy around. We want to hear your story about what that day will or will not mean to you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or you can always send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Now, Adora, it should be simple. On February 10th, we have a new consumer safety law that goes into effect. It's aimed at keeping lead away from our kids. But whose job is it to keep the lead out? Well, backers of the new law say it isn't aimed at retailers. Small business owners are worried that they're bearing the brunt for enforcing the law, which requires them to test goods for lead content. Now, those who sell secondhand goods like toys and clothes for kids, they're especially upset, and they think it's going to put them out of business. We're going to talk to both sides today, starting with Marilyn Seitz. She runs the not-for-profit Pennyworth shop in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hey, Marilyn, how is this new law going to affect your business?
We are extremely concerned. The guidelines are, even their recent press release, was very inconsistent, and we have no straight guidelines on how to do this. As volunteers and parents, and I'm a retired teacher, we want to be compliant. We want to protect children. We certainly have that concern. But we also are trying to, I'm a manager, like you said, of the thrift shop, and we are trying to do the right thing. But there's no possible way that my volunteers and I, and the average age is in the mid-70s, could possibly research or test all these tiny individual items. I don't get any mass toys. They don't come in bundles. They come one by one. And there's no possible way that we could possibly be in compliant the way the law is written right now.
Okay.
And that's my question.
All right, Marilyn. Well, I was just going to say, now hang on a minute. We're joined on the line here by Scott Wolfson. He is a spokesman at the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Hey, Scott, thanks for joining us.
Good morning to all of you.
Okay. Now, Marilyn, go ahead. Just focus that question down, and here's your shot. You go ahead and ask Scott directly, what is it that is most bothersome to you?
There's no possibility that thrift stores that are made mostly of retired citizens, volunteers, can test or guarantee that our toys are not on the recall list or have lead content. What can we do to be compliant with this new law?
All right, Scott, we've put you on the spot here. What are you going to say?
Marilyn, I appreciate that question, and there's two key points that I want to share with you. Number one, CPSC is not looking to shutter your doors or the doors of thrift shops all across the country. We put out guidance, and it wasn't CPSC reinterpreting the law. We want to be very clear to you and really stop the misinformation campaign on the Internet. You, as a reseller, do not have a mandate to test and certify the products on your shelves. But the second key point, and this was reiterated at the top, and I'd say it again, this is a new child safety law. We need to restore the confidence of parents as they go into retail, as they go to thrift stores, that what they're purchasing for their children is safe. Therefore, you do have an obligation come February 10th that what you sell meets new, stricter lead limits, phthalate limits, which is a chemical that's concerned some people, and new, stricter toy safety standards.
Hey, Scott,
now,
hang on.
How can we do that?
Yeah, thank you, Marilyn.
How can we do that? That is ludicrous. There's no way that I can guarantee that my in a thrift shop, things come in bags and bundles, and they're not in the original packaging. There's absolutely no way that we can test these
or
certify
let Scott
on a recall list. It's 15 pages long, single space.
Okay.
How can we possibly do that?
And Scott, a chance to respond here.
So, Marilyn, we understand that the resources are too tight for you to be able to test. So that's why we've begun to give some of that guidance that we put out last week, that if you have had a history, whether it's your store or others across the country, if you've been in the business of, like, reselling children's metal jewelry, here's a product line where there's been 50 recalls over 4 years. A child died. Others have been poisoned.
Jewelry is easy. Okay, we can get rid of jewelry. Toys, stuffed animals, clothing, books. How do we do we wipe them out and throw the baby out with a bathtub, or do we close down our shops? That's our only alternatives.
Marilyn, you as a proprietor are going to have some tough decisions to make. This is what the law does. It does put it kind of on your shoulders. And what we're saying is you do need to go product line by product line and know what has been safe in the past.
15 pages long? 15 pages long.
Marilyn, you absolutely
have an obligation, first and foremost, under this law and what CPSC has been doing for 30 years. You cannot sell a previously. There's no debate there about that, Marilyn. What we're getting to is some of the other areas where there haven't been recalls, but you still need to make a pro-safety decision for your customers based on new, tougher safety standards.
Scott, I want you to very succinctly address this catch-22. What tools can your commission give these people to help them uphold this law?
The best we can do is give some guidance of product lines over the years that have had some problems that could show signs of being even more problematic when the tougher standards go into place. So when we're talking about wooden toys that have paint on the surface, if you look back to 2007, this is why we're at the place we're at right now, because Thomas the Train was recalled and the Mattel and the Fisher-Price toys. We had the highest levels of lead paint violations on toys in the history of the agency.
That's Scott Wolfson and Marilyn Seitz. I thank you both for joining us this morning. Scott Wolfson, spokesman for the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. He joined us from Bethesda, Maryland. Marilyn Seitz, the manager of the not-for-profit Pennyworth Shop in Silver Spring, Maryland. Thanks again. Femi Oke is here with the latest from the newsroom.
Good morning. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Wall Street is open for business. I checked just a moment ago, the Dow was down 150 points, the S&P down around about 18 points. Militants in Lebanon launched another attack into northern Israel today. Israel responded by firing back. They say the Lebanese government is responsible for preventing the attacks. And meanwhile, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is in Cairo working on plans for a ceasefire. The Pentagon confirmed today that a detainee who's being held at Guantanamo Bay has been subject to torture. It's the first time interrogation techniques such as waterboarding and sleep deprivation have been labelled as such. The charges against the detainee have been dropped. Provisions placed on the remaining TARP bailout funds are still being revised. The House removed a stipulation yesterday that restricted use of private jets by banks receiving funds, but Kansas lawmakers complained. Kansas is a hub of aircraft manufacturing, and they say the restriction would cost the state jobs. So how many cups of coffee have you had so far this morning? One, two, seven? If it's seven, you may be subject to hallucinations, seeing things and hearing things as well. That's according to researchers at Durham University. They were studying students who drank more than seven cups of coffee, and they suffered from hallucinations.
Oh, who's counting?
That's news you can use. Thanks very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanford, in for John Hockenberry. Hey, Adora, remember about 5 years ago, then-General Eric Shinseki made headlines for clashing with the Bush administration on Iraq war policy. Listen to this tape from a congressional hearing.
What's been mobilized to this point, something on the order of several hundred thousand soldiers are probably a figure that would be required.
That was an estimate from the general that was belittled by his superiors. It turned out to be a prescient statement, however, because that is eventually what happened. But by then, Shinseki was out of a job. Flash forward to today, where he's expected to have relatively smooth sailing at a Senate confirmation hearing in his bid to lead the Veterans Affairs Department under Barack Obama. How is today's hearing going to be different from that one some years ago? For more, we're going to go to Larry Korb. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a former assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Nice to be with you.
Now, let's talk about what you think that hearing's going to be like today. Any kind of contention going to be there?
No, I don't think so, because back in 2003, when General Shinseki talked about how many troops will be needed to occupy Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein. The Republicans were in charge of the committee. None of them followed up when Senator Levin asked General Shinseki the question that he gave this now famous answer to. So I think they're not going to give him a hard time. And the other thing is that General Shinseki did retire in the June of that year and has basically been silent then. He has not come out like a lot of people might and say, well, I told you so, you should have listened to me. I mean, he has gone off and acted very, very professionally, refused to, you know, to capitalize, if you will, on being being correct. And the other thing is that he himself is also a wounded veteran. He lost part of his foot in Vietnam. So here you have a person who's qualified, who's been right, and who basically has conducted himself, you know, above reproach.
What is going to be his top priority?
Well, I think his top priority has got to be to get the veteran system large enough to accommodate the unexpected number, an unanticipated number of people who have suffered both physical and mental wounds as a result of the long wars, particularly in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan, something that the Bush administration did not anticipate, and so they've been playing catch up ball the whole time.
Now, you hear a lot about Priority 8, mid-income veterans. What are we talking about there?
Say that again.
The Priority 8, the middle-income veterans who didn't necessarily qualify for benefits under the Bush administration.
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, what is happening is that people who left the service and seemed to be okay, and then, of course, they began to suffer, you know, mental problems, and people began to talk about whether, in fact, that, you know, this was a result of the war, also a lot of people who were members of Guard and Reserve were called up, and then they went back to their civilian jobs, and they didn't get in contact with the Veterans Administration,
right.
And they also were
Larry
not.
Larry Korb, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much
okay.
for your thoughts in the Shinseki hearing today.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 14th. Femi Okeh has joined us with the latest headlines.
And the time is 30 minutes to the top of the hour. More tough economic news this morning, confirming fears of a dismal holiday shopping season. Retail sales plunged 2.7% in December. That's more than twice as bad as Wall Street analysts thought, and it's a record 6 months in a row of declines. New developments in an Oakland killing that sparked riots. Authorities have arrested a former transit police officer. He's accused of shooting an unarmed black man in the back of a train platform. And when the shooting happened, the suspect was a transit cop. He resigned after refusing to talk to police investigators. And several passengers took cell phone images of the shooting, which have been widely viewed online. A cold snap has brought sub-freezing temperatures and snow to several Midwestern states. And this has led to hundreds of flight cancellations. And that frosty weather system is now heading east. And finally, President Bush is thinking ahead to next week and his plans for retirement. He told CNN's Larry King what he's going to be doing when he leaves office.
I'm going to be involved with building a presidential center at Southern Methodist University, to which will be attached a library and, and archives. And I'm probably going to write a book, tend to write a book.
And First Lady Laura Bush is also going to be writing a book. The president also said he's going to take up some mountain biking, visit national parks, and continue his work with HIV and malaria prevention in Africa. And that's a look at your news for now.
Sounds like a pretty good retirement plan.
Busy man.
Thanks very much, Femi. In about 10 minutes from now, confirmation hearings begin for Lisa Jackson. She is President-elect Obama's pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency. Jackson is currently the commissioner of New Jersey's Department of Environmental Protection. But with Obama creating new positions such as Energy Czar, will the role of the EPA director be diminished or redefined? For more, we're joined by former Governor Christine Todd Whitman. She was the former governor of New Jersey and the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency herself under the Bush administration. She's currently the founder of the Whitman Strategy Group, a business which deals with issues like climate change and green development. Good morning and welcome back, Governor.
Good morning. It's great to talk to you again.
Lisa Jackson certainly has a tough job ahead of her if she is confirmed, but she is coming in with some very interesting and sound experience as a mechanical engineer and the head of the New Jersey Environmental Protection Agency. What do you make of her?
I think she's a wonderful choice there. She also worked at the EPA for a while, so she knows the agency, she knows the issues, she's run a department. This is obviously a step up because there's nothing that can compare to the federal level of government in the state, but she has the requisite qualifications. But my concern for her is, as you pointed out just a minute ago, with an energy czar who, and oh, by the way, that energy czar in the White House used to be the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency and clearly has a great deal of interest in the environment. The thing that Lisa has to get very clear very early on with the administration is who is going to speak on the environment. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be the White House? Because also you have the head of the White House Office of Council on Environmental Quality, which is supposed to coordinate environmental policy across an administration, who is a Carol Browner protege. So it's going to make it difficult.
Clearly a very different job than the one that you had when you have this relationship between the EPA and a very strong presence in the White House. At some point, is it a question of too many cooks in the kitchen?
Well, that's something that worries me. When you have so many people who have strong feelings about the environment, who are in positions of authority, who can obviously speak to the public in general, the press, and to the business and the NGOs, you need to be sure who it is that's actually articulating the policy that the president wants to follow, because otherwise things fall through the cracks. People blame one another. If things don't happen in the kind of way that you want them to, it was difficult enough when there's always a tension between the Environmental Protection Agency and the Council on Environmental Quality. But when you have layer on top of that a very prominent energy czar, that's going to make the mix even more difficult to interpret, really, frankly, for people on the outside. And Lisa needs to try to get a handle on that as quickly as she can.
Would it be your estimation that clarity would really come from President-elect Obama himself, that he would really be the only person who could clearly lay out what the expectation for each of those roles will be?
Yes, absolutely. She needs to sit down with him, or she needs to sit down with Podesta, the chief of staff, and make sure that they make some pronouncement on that, understanding that it's going to be a continuous battle. These kinds of things in Washington, the president can say one thing. The president gets caught up with a whole lot of major issues on his plate. This isn't going to be number one as to who's speaking, and you're going to have to constantly fight the battle and push people back into their places. But Lisa is somebody who is going to be very good for the agency, I believe, and can be very good for the environment of the country, and she certainly is going to have a supportive president.
Speaking of something else that she's going to have, the Supreme Court has ruled that the EPA has power to regulate carbon dioxide. Talk about what kind of importance that ruling is going to have.
Well, that has enormous importance. As soon as that ruling came down, members of the agency and the Office of Air started working on what a regulatory framework would look like to implement that ruling. And it's going to be up to the administration to decide how far they want to go. This basically is the first step in a cap-and-trade program, or in our finally upfront dealing with the issue of climate change. And it's going to be the devil is very much in the details here. It's going to be extremely complicated. Do you do it industry by industry, or do you try to do the whole country all at once? How do you set the standards? You have to know exactly what each emitter has been emitting up until this point. It's complicated. And it would be far better, I believe, and we'd get things happening faster, if Congress were to pass legislation that established a cap-and-trade program, or if Congress were to set the, not the standards because they don't know it, but they, at least to set up the you know, the parameters of how it gets done.
And that's a perfect segue, talking about Congress, because there's a major change in the House where you have Representative John Dingell being replaced by Henry Waxman to run the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Would you expect then that the EPA would get a better reception?
Well, it's a hole in your definition of better. They'll certainly get a strong reception, but it comes down to a question of whether it's going to go further, whether Waxman and the Congress are going to want to go further faster than the administration's going to want to go. And that's another one of those balancing acts that are going to be somewhat difficult because, you know, we've got to the president is facing an economic crisis the likes of which we haven't seen in our lifetimes. And that's going to have to balance against what you do to address the issue of climate change. And the reason I said it would be better if Congress acted on the carbon issue, because that is the climate change issue, is that when they act, that's the law. When the EPA promulgates a regulation, that goes to court. And that can slow things down forever.
And that is a very long process, given all of the due process requirements. But overall, given the developments in science, given the fact that this is an administration incoming that says the environment is a priority, would you expect that we will see something very different from the EPA than we've seen for the last 7 years?
Absolutely, without question. I mean, you have an administration who a president-elect who said from the beginning that this is a major issue, that he wants to address it, well, as did John McCain. He also said climate change is a major issue, and he wanted to put a cap on carbon. So that's a totally different mindset than what we've had over the last 8 years.
Christine Todd Whitman, thank you very much. Christine Todd Whitman is the former governor of New Jersey, the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency under the Bush administration, and now the founder of the Whitman Strategy Group.
All right, Adora, it's less than a week before the inauguration. We are looking for your stories. Are you going? Are you celebrating with friends at home? We want to follow you as you commemorate Barack Obama's inauguration.
Hello, my name is Lion. I'm from Antigua in the Caribbean. I'm a citizen of the United States. I don't drink, but I am going to get drunk on inauguration day.
Hey, this is Bobby Allen from South Carolina. I'm going to be working like I normally do and thankful that the process can move along without me. And actually, I wish people would leave him alone and let him do his job.
I'm Sandy, and I am living in Englewood. The theater in Englewood is having a free open house all day, and they're going to have entertainment. And I'm looking forward to celebrating this with the whole city that I love.
Oh, my. That was a whole continuum of
it's
plans.
Quite
and that's
the range.
Why we're asking, because we're trying to put a face to those numbers.
Okay, 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here is your takeaway.
Citigroup's ad slogan used to be, "The city never sleeps." I think it now should be City Sleeps with the Fishes.
And that's our friend Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek. We're always on. Want to remind you, we also have a podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org, iTunes.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.